Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a posse of angry old white men in the White House and the Republican Senate, determined to plow through with the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, regardless of Thursday's testimony by Dr. Blasey Ford, and have a vote of the full Senate on his confirmation as early as next Monday or Tuesday. Bob Schiff, an attorney who served as chief counsel for former Senator Russ Feingold for 12 years and is the co-author of an article at Time magazine, "Brett Kavanaugh Can't Be Trusted. We know because we worked as counsel to senators when he was in the Bush White House," joins us. We will discuss the contrast between the growing evidence against Kavanaugh and the increasing resolve of the Republicans to ram his confirmation through the Senate, in stark contrast to the 8 months Mitch McConnell held up Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court, who never even got a hearing. We'll assess whether Kavanaugh's third accuser, who her lawyer Michael Avenatti is scheduled to unveil on Wednesday, could be sufficient for Senators Collins and Murkowski to break from the lockstep of GOP determination not to have an FBI investigation into these new and perhaps even more damning charges. Apparently, she is accusing both Kavanaugh and his friend Mark Judge, who the Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee are preventing from testifying. Then we will speak with the founder of Pass Blue, Dulcy Limebach, who has covered the United Nations for decades and was an editor of the New York Times for more than 20 years. She joins us to discuss President Trump's address to the United Nations General Assembly, at which his absurd boasts about being the greatest president ever, who has achieved a miraculous turnaround, having made America great again in just 2 years, was greeted with mocking laughter from the leaders of the world gathered in the chamber. We will assess whether the two-thirds of Americans who are embarrassed by Trump's pandering to the ignorant isolationist delusions of the one-third minority of the country who believe a global bureaucracy is about to destroy America's sovereignty will stand up and be counted in November. Then finally, with President Trump chairing tomorrow's UN Security Council meeting at which he's expected to single out Iran as enemy number one, we will speak with revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations, Mansour Farhang, a professor emeritus of international relations at Bennington College. He joins us to discuss the overheated belligerent threats today from Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, warning Iran, quote, "If you cross us, our allies or our partners, if you harm our citizens, if you continue to lie, cheat and deceive, yes, there will indeed be hell to pay." And joining us now is Bob Schiff, who is an attorney who served as chief counsel for former Senator Russ Feingold for 12 years. He's the co-author of the article at Time magazine, "Brett Kavanaugh Can't Be Trusted. We know because we worked as counsels to senators when he was in the Bush White House." Welcome to Background Briefing, Bob Schiff.
Thank you.
So I guess at this point, the question arises, how did a womanizer, a drunk, and a gambler get this far? I mean, this is pretty extraordinary. When you look at the record that you have, that Lisa Graves and others have compiled from their experience with Brett Kavanaugh in terms of his basic honesty, but it seems like every other day now something's coming out of the woodwork. Michael Avenatti's got a woman lined up to drop another bomb on Kavanaugh. Senator Whitehouse asked him about his peculiar influxes of money, for which there's very little explanation, and whether he has a gambling problem. No adequate answers have come on any of these major questions. So is this a case of the sort of Republican Federalist establishment led by Leonard Leo just pushing people forth with unusual power and influence that they have? What would explain it to you or to our audience?
Yeah, I think that what you said is actually quite very much at the bottom of this. Brett Kavanaugh has been preparing, and he has been prepared by others, groomed for this position for his entire professional career. I mean, starting when he worked with Ken Starr on the independent counsel investigation of President Clinton and was the co-author of the Starr Report, moving on then to being a foot soldier in the Bush v. Gore recount in Florida, and then taking over in the White House, they have been, you know, looking for someone like him to be on the Supreme Court, and that's a long process. You have to get somebody on the circuit court first. And so after he played a key role in packing the circuit court with like-minded conservative ideologues in the early 2000s, he was then nominated himself. And he has been on the circuit court for 12 years, being the kind of judge that they expected him to be and that he had every desire to be, and now is being elevated to the Supreme Court. And the only reason that we know now about all of his lies during that process of being confirmed to the circuit court is because documents are finally available under the Presidential Records Act that show that he was not being truthful with the Senate committee back in 2004 and 2006. We didn't know back then. We asked the questions, but he deflected and lied to us in those two hearings prior to being confirmed to the D.C. Circuit, and it's only now coming out, just as many of these other situations are coming out very late in the game, but I think it's important for the Senate to consider them.
So is this arrogance on Leonard Leo's part that, I mean, he also got Gorsuch through, and Gorsuch, of course, went to the same Catholic boys' prep school, Georgetown Prep, that's now getting so much attention because of the pervasive drunkenness that went on amongst the student body, including Brett Kavanaugh, and in particular his friend Mark Judge, who wrote a book about them all being inebriated, etc. So, you know, there's a pattern here. I mean, Leonard Leo, of course, is a Opus Dei, very conservative Catholic. If you look at the list that they've got on so far, conservative Catholic, John Roberts, Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, and now Kavanaugh, or at least they're hoping to get Kavanaugh on. I'm not being conspiratorial here. I'm just saying this doesn't represent the broad spectrum of American life. In other words, these are the most powerful people in the land, and many would argue, in terms of their lasting effect on our lives. Yet it does seem that they're recruiting justices from a very narrow pool of extremely conservative Catholics.
I think that's right. I'm not sure that lumping them all together is quite fair, and I'd be fairly confident that Leonard Leo didn't know anything about Brett Kavanaugh's ill-spent youth and how far badly it went. These are people right from the same mold, with very conservative ideological views from coming from privilege. Generally, I actually don't know about Alito's background or can't remember it, but. I think the more important point is they know what they're getting. They don't have to ask any of these candidates, would you reverse Roe v. Wade? Because they have been told that, you know, in many different ways. So Kavanaugh's dissent in the case in the D.C. Circuit recently, where you had the undocumented immigrant from who was in custody and wanted an abortion, that opinion was a message that I can be trusted when I go on the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. And on any number of other issues, all of these judges made clear during their circuit court times that they would be down-the-line conservatives who would take the position of corporations over individuals, of the executive branch over Congress, and right down the line of companies over unions, et cetera.
Well, that was particularly evident with Gorsuch, because Gorsuch effectively auditioned for the Federalists in the so-called frozen truck driver case, where a truck driver, his rig broke down in the dead of winter in an ice storm, and he had a choice of either to freeze to death or go and abandon his rig and get help. And Gorsuch went out of his way to be the only judge to vote against the truck driver, in effect saying that the guy should have frozen to death. That seemed to be an audition to show that he was a zealous corporatist.
Absolutely, and there's a very similar case that maybe hasn't gotten as much attention because of all of the all of the other issues that have come up with Kavanaugh. But he wrote a decision in a case called SeaWorld, basically saying that OSHA could not regulate SeaWorld to prevent, could not issue a regulation that would prevent SeaWorld from forcing its employees to go out and interact with sharks that had actually injured people before. But this was not something that was covered by OSHA's, you know, safety regulations. But very much the same kind of, you know, corporate power over individual rights of employees.
And again, I'm speaking with Bob Schiff, who's an attorney who served as chief counsel for former Senator Russ Feingold for 12 years. He's the co-author of the article at Time Magazine, "Brett Kavanaugh Can't Be Trusted." We know because he worked as counsel to senators when he was in the Bush White House. So where do you see this heading now? There's been a really ramping up of fairly sort of hostile, if not thuggish, rhetoric coming from the majority leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, who's just absolutely going to push this thing through. Orrin Hatch, of course, is making peculiar sort of remarks, patriarchal and perhaps even senile remarks. And the president himself has now weighed in, saying this whole thing is a con job by the Democrats. So nobody knows about what's going to happen on Thursday in terms of the format that they've devised. Republicans are being very secretive about who possibly might be the female prosecutor asking questions. So how much do you think the deck is stacked against Christine Blasey Ford?
Well, I think the deck is stacked against her, but I think also the Republicans at this point are just trying to check a box of giving her a chance to air her allegations, and then they want to just move forward and have a vote. Much as we would like there to have been an inquiry on the facts, much as we would like the Republicans to say, well, if he did this, he should not be on the Supreme Court, it seems clear that for most of them, this is just a roadblock to be maneuvered around. And with this idea that they're going to have someone else question her, that is just a purely political maneuver to try to avoid the embarrassment of an all-male Republican side questioning, almost certainly in an aggressive and unkind manner, for the American people to see. This is, in the end, a political process. And Mitch McConnell has made it clear he doesn't care about these allegations, true or false. They've set up the hearing to be as close as possible to a he said, she said encounter so that Republicans who want to vote for him will be able to say it just hasn't been proven. And so I'm going to confirm him. He's a good man. And the hearing is a show, and there are reports that they want to try to move this out of committee on Friday and to the floor of the Senate on Monday and Tuesday and try to confirm Judge Kavanaugh next week. Many people have said that this is a danger to the reputation of the Supreme Court if they go ahead and put someone on it without resolving these allegations. But I guess my view is that that didn't stop them from confirming Clarence Thomas, and it certainly hasn't. There's been no indication that Thomas has any regrets or that the Supreme Court has suffered because of having someone on it for the last 25 years who faced these kinds of allegations and very well may have been guilty of them. So I think from the Republican point of view, getting Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court is the ballgame. That's why they wanted Donald Trump to be elected. That's why they've been putting up with his antics for the last almost 2 years. They get their majority on the Supreme Court, and they can start attacking precedents like Roe v. Wade and the Affordable Care Act and everything else that the previous court, by a very narrow margin, had been able to protect for the American people.
So what are we to make then of the two women that essentially, I don't know what you could say, they're being targeted by the Democrats, but they're, first of all, Susan Collins has gone out of her way to say that she actually believed Brett Kavanaugh's assurances about Roe v. Wade, and you've made it clear that he's sent the opposite assurances to those that are behind him and have elevated him. And then Lisa Murkowski just said today that maybe we should hear from Deborah Ramirez, who's the subject of the accusation coming from Kavanaugh's days at Yale as an undergraduate. The president, of course, has weighed in and trashed her as well. And also you've got Corker and Jeff Flake. It's odd that these two, particularly Corker and Flake, seem to be free to criticize the president, but they always vote in lockstep with the Republicans. So do you think there's any chance of the two women having a come-to-Jesus moment?
Well, I think there's a chance. And I think that, you know, pressure on them from their constituents is part of what needs to happen. It seems like both Collins and Murkowski have kept somewhat of an open mind and certainly are less inclined to dismiss the allegations from Dr. Ford and Ms. Ramirez than their colleagues. I mean, Corker and Flake would have voted in favor of Kavanaugh right from the start. They feel free to play a little bit of a middle ground because they don't really care about the president's base and about the president himself being critical of them. But you're right. They've never voted on anything in a way that would suggest they want to use that independence to block a Supreme Court nomination. So I think Murkowski and Collins are very important. And it's distressing because, of course, there are other women senators on the Republican side. There's Joni Ernst. There's Shelley Moore Capito. There's Deb Fischer. These are, you know, they're all women, and presumably they are, you know, they are know that these allegations have at least the ring of truth. I mean, I find these both of these women believable. There's a variety of reasons for that, but. You just would think that more senators would be concerned about putting someone on the Supreme Court who has this dark past, potentially. And let me just also say, with respect to Ms. Ramirez's allegations, which have just come out recently, you hear a lot of, well, there's no corroboration. Well, actually, the corroboration is not eyewitness testimony, necessarily. It's people who heard something about it at the time, and remember that clearly. It's people that may have heard it from her or may have been down the hall when someone shouted out what Brett Kavanaugh had done. That is corroborating evidence, and the fact that there seems to be no interest in having the FBI interview all of the relevant people and investigate these and try to come to some conclusion of what actually happened, I think pretty much tells you everything you want to know about the Republicans' attitude towards the allegations. They really don't care if this is true. They want their men on the court.
Well, in terms of corroboration to Deborah Ramirez, Kavanaugh's freshman roommate at Yale says, quote, although Brett was normally reserved, he was a notably heavy drinker, even by the standards of the time, and that he became belligerent and aggressive when he was very drunk. And I mentioned Mark Judge's book, which was pretty graphic about them being hammered all the time. And, of course, in the yearbook, Brett Kavanaugh talks about 100 kegs of beer being some kind of important badge of honor of his, along with suggesting, amongst others, of his buddies that they had some kind of woman that they all shared in a, I don't know, I won't get into the details of that, but it's a bit murky. But what's now happening is a third shoe is about to drop with Michael Abernathy, who is a sort of pugnacious ambulance chaser, but he certainly knows how to get media attention, and he's found somebody. I'll just quote from Abernathy's tweet. I represent a woman with credible information regarding Judge Kavanaugh and Mark Judge. We will be demanding the opportunity to present testimony to the committee and will likewise be demanding that Judge and others be subpoenaed to testify. The nomination must be withdrawn. Very odd. What can I say? Crazy town is getting crazier, right? But
it's an unusual way to proceed because, of course, those demands have been made by Senate Democrats for the last 2 weeks and are falling on deaf ears. So, but it does point out the peril for the Republican senators if they go forward in a rush and confirm Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, because if the person that Mr. Abernathy represents is a credible witness when we finally find out who she is and what she says, and if there is corroborating evidence of her allegations, there is, you know, someone on the Supreme Court who really has a past that, you know, we really would not want to see in someone who's in that position. So it's a risk for the Republicans, but so far that particular allegation is just a reported, you know, threat as opposed to something tangible. I guess I would really like to see the senators Murkowski and Collins say to their leaders that they will not vote to confirm Kavanaugh on Monday or Tuesday unless there is an adequate investigation, because they are actually interested in the facts of these two witnesses and potentially three the allegations that they've made before making their decision. That, it seems to me, would you know, stop Mitch McConnell from going forward, because he needs both of their votes, assuming that the three Democrats who have still not announced their position would not vote to confirm him either.
Well, I think this whole situation with these two women and possibly a third has given the Democrats cover. But just to finish up on Avenatti, this woman is going to appear. I mean, this is not an empty promise on his part. I'm sure she's going to show up, and he's already saying that we had high-level security clearances in both the State Department, the U.S. Mint, and the Department of Justice, implying that she'd be a very credible witness. So I think we can expect to see her and hear from her, surely.
I would think so. You certainly would hope so after the buildup that Michael Avenatti has given this. And I think he said last night within 36 hours, so we're talking about sometime on tomorrow morning, I guess, that we will finally find out if he's keeping to his own deadline. But it's a crazy way to run a railway. I mean, you know, one thing the Senate does not do well is act under pressure with a time deadline to find facts. I mean, the idea that this kind of proceeding is going to be illuminating of much more other than the incompetence of at least some senators is a little bit surprising.
Well, so well, not only we'll of course that, yeah, not only of course are they denying Christine Blasey Ford the opportunity to have Kavanaugh testify first and then she to respond, he has the advantage of listening to what she has to say and then rebutting it, and then of course there'll be a female prosecutor asking questions. But they've also been very firm about not having Mark Judge testify, and he's a witness in terms of Christine Blasey Ford's accusation. So that is pretty extraordinary. Yeah. But that's why I find the Avenatti business of singling out Mark Judge with this third woman having evidence about him, that sounds like potentially explosive.
So it does. Yeah. It does. I mean, I think of the three demands that Dr. Ford's attorneys made. That's the most significant one. I mean, I think the other two, don't really make this an unfair process. But not having the other person that she said was in the room subpoenaed and interrogated about this just seems like an effort to, again, to set up a he said, she said, as opposed to actually finding out what actually happened.
Well, Bob Schiff, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Bob Schiff, who's an attorney who served as chief counsel for former Senator Russ Feingold for 12 years. He's the co-author of the article at Time magazine, Brett Kavanaugh Can't Be Trusted. We know because we worked as counsel to senators when he was in the Bush White House. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing President Trump's address to the United Nations General Assembly today, at which his absurd boasts about him being the greatest president ever, having achieved a miraculous turnaround and made America great again in just 2 years, was greeted with mocking laughter from the leaders of the world.
That you want me to do? Yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah?
We've all seen enough. Now it's time to decide.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dulcie Limebach, who's the founder of Pass Blue, for which she edits and writes. It covers primarily the United Nations, West Africa, peacekeeping operations, and women's issues. And previously, she was an editor for the Coalition for the UN Convention Against Corruption and was the publications director of the United Nations Association of the United States of America, and was an editor at the New York Times for more than 20 years. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dulcie Limebach.
Thank you.
And you have spent the day at the UN, as has President Trump. He addressed the General Assembly today. He told the General Assembly, essentially, the gathering of all the world leaders, that he was paraphrasing the greatest president ever. He's turned America around just in 2 years, where he's made America great again. And he was greeted, as he boasted in this embarrassingly narcissistic way, it was greeted by mocking laughter from literally the representatives of the rest of the world. So how did it strike you? You're an American citizen. He represents you. He represents me. He represents all of us. How do you feel?
It's pretty embarrassing. It was sort of stunning because when it happened, we all sort of looked up at each other in the correspondence area and we thought, did that really happen? And then we looked over the notes later, and we all confirmed it did happen. Even the U.S. mission to the U.N. in sending out Trump's speech verbatim had that actual episode. But they even put in parens laughter, and then Trump's remark to that laughter, and then they put in parens laughter and applause. But I was just talking to my reporter, and we actually don't think there was applause. But if there was applause, it was meant to sort of reinforce the laughter and the whole ridiculousness of what Trump said. So as someone said, the joke was on Trump, and we're not sure he got it. But it was sort of amazing to see the world laughing at America. But this is what we're up against right now. And I've never seen the UN react so viscerally to an American president this way in such a public setting. It was stunning. So it never ceases to amaze us what he says at the UN, and his other cabinet members as well, including Nikki Haley.
Well, she's been a fairly reliable sycophant, as has Pompeo. But the one person who came out swinging today at the UN was John Bolton. He really went over the top attacking Iran, saying they have hell to pay and accusing them of, well, he's almost like a gunfighter at the OK Corral. You know, he said, if you cross us, our allies or our partners, if you harm our citizens, if you continue to lie, cheat, and deceive us, there will indeed be hell to pay. Does anybody know what he's talking about?
Well, I guess, is it the Straits of Hormuz that Iran could ostensibly block passage of, the waterways? They're talking, I don't know when Bolton actually said this, but maybe it was before the president of Iran spoke, which was sort of early this afternoon. It's unclear what Bolton is talking about, but this is rhetoric. They love to toss out and sort of create this fear-mongering. So it's just all a matter of fear-mongering. But our theory basically about the whole speech-making by Trump and today and even yesterday, he led a global meeting on the drug crisis in the world. This is all pandering to the American audience before the midterm elections. So that's our take on all these speeches, that they're just trying to reinforce that Trump's America First agenda when they're at the UN, because there's, you know, a lot is being broadcast. So the whole idea is to make sure that the American electorate is listening, and what they hear is that Trump has, you know, basically made America not only great, but super great. So that's what this speech making's about.
Right, but Dulcie Lineback, when you talk about the American audience, how much of America, I mean, you and I are both embarrassed, and I think a lot of people are embarrassed by what happened, to, that the United States was laughed at because it has such a buffoon and an embarrassment as a president. Obviously, within his base, that's not happening, and I'm sure Fox News has presented a totally different picture of what happened today at the United Nations. But Trump is clearly getting his ideas from the most far fringes of the right wing in this country, from the Alex Jones kind of world of conspiracy, the idea that the real enemies in the world are not Russia, China, Iran, or whatever, you know, Venezuela. Of course, he went after Venezuela, but he went after socialism. And he went after globalism and this kind of idea of a secret world government. I mean, this is really shocking. Where is he getting his information from?
Well, we think he's that the speech was partly written by Stephen Miller, who, of course, wrote the speech last year at the UN, which was heavily focused on, quote, sovereignty, or, you know, the sovereign right of a nation. This year, we think there's a lot of Bolton in that speech, particularly on Iran and, you know, moving away from globalism to, I can't remember the exact words, but patriotism. So we feel that there is a mix of John Bolton in there and, to some extent, Nikki Haley's Tea Party belief in terms of, you know, the freedom of the individual. We have to return to the freedom of the individual in America. Again, this is election mongering. This is, you know, this is what Trump does when he goes out on the campaign trail to the states that love him or the places that love him. And he says these things. And so this is really just in keeping with what he says a lot that some of us may not be listening to.
Well, it's just that the gulf between the reality of America being the dominant power, and tomorrow he's going to be chairing the UN Security Council, and they're going to beat up on Iran, and the U.S. has got the power in the world to basically force its allies to go along with the secondary sanctions against Iran. And they're trying to obviously get Iran to break the nuclear deal, which the U.S. reneged on. So there's an example of the power of the United States. You have the German delegation laughing in Trump's face today at the U.N. because he says that how dependent they are on foreign energy, et cetera. And they're just laughing at the absurdity of what he's saying. But what is it about the American people, or at least a subset of the American people, that would honestly believe that the world's lone superpower is this beleaguered nation whose sovereignty is about to be stolen by an unaccountable global bureaucracy?
Well, it feeds into this sector's belief that the UN is worthless and that the UN, you know, and the people at the UN want to take over the world and tell the Americans what to do, including, you know, their right to the Second Amendment to carry guns. So it's just, it's been working. You know, that's the problem. This mindset, this sort of extreme right rhetoric works because, you know, we're now living in two worlds in the United States, those that don't believe these things and those that choose to or choose to deny the reality because it empowers them. You know, they have this president who's speaking what they want him to say.
Right, but this clown represents all of us. He's only speaking to, at the best, one-third of us. What's happening to the two-thirds? Are they going to put up with this stuff? It's so embarrassing. It's beyond belief.
Well, we'll see on November 6th, you know, who votes and who wins. Uh-huh. I mean, to see, you know, the camera at in the General Assembly during Trump's speech was panning the room. And so when he said that you know, Germany dependence on Russia is you know, really bad. The camera panned to the German delegates. You know, Angela Merkel's not here, smartly. But, I mean, the delegates, including the foreign minister of Germany, they were laughing. I mean, not laughing, but they were, like, you know, guffawing. It was just like, you know, are we? What is going on here? And then when Trump made his dig about socialism, the camera panned to Sweden. And they were like rolling their eyes. So you know, there are limits to what these countries can do when the American president is up there making these fulminations. What can they do? You know, Europe is in a tough place itself, so it's hard for them to really come together. They try a lot here at the UN as elected members of the Council. They try to have media briefings and reinforce the European point of view versus the American point of view. But, you know, Europe doesn't have a Trump to stand up on a podium like that and you know, foment them out, which, you know, you only need one Trump. You don't need two. But, you know, in subtle ways, Europe and the rest of the world, if you listen to the speeches today, they all had digs and they all said, you know, we must stick to the rule of order, the rule of law. There's no other way. So, you know, as Gloria Steinem said, you know, there are more of us than them in terms of Trump supporters. But, you know, it's just the tide hasn't turned too quickly back to the real world.
Well, Dulcie Limebeck, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Dulcie Limebeck, who is the founder of Pass Blue, for which she edits and writes. It covers primarily the United Nations, West Africa, peacekeeping operations, and women's issues. And previously was an editor for the Coalition for the UN Convention Against Corruption and was the publications director of the United Nations Association of the USA and was an editor at the New York Times for more than 20 years. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into John Bolton's overheated belligerent threats against Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mansour Farang, who's a professor emeritus of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendation to release its U.S. hostages. His books include U.S. Imperialism, The Spanish-American War to the Iranian Revolution, and The U.S. Press and Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mansour Farah. So, Mansour, what do you expect tomorrow? President Trump will be chairing the UN Security Council, and they're expected to discuss Iran. But already today at the UN, John Bolton, Trump's national security advisor, went out of his way to be belligerent towards Iran, saying, quote, "I might imagine that they would take me seriously when I assure them today, if you cross us, our allies or our partners, if you harm our citizens, if you continue to lie, cheat and deceive, yes, there will indeed be hell to pay." First of all, what's he talking about? I mean, I haven't noticed any attacks on American citizens from Iran lately. You, of course, were there during the hostage crisis, which I think in many ways has shaped the relationship for the worst, if you will. But how do you see this kind of combination of belligerence and hyperbole?
John Bolton and a number of other people who are in his category in terms of foreign policy orientation, expected when the United States withdrew from the nuclear deal, they expected Iran to do the same. And by doing that, that is returning to enrichment of uranium the way it was before the nuclear deal, it would definitely anger the European Union, even Russia and China, because they were all involved in negotiating with Iran. And then if Iran did that, that is to say, ask the inspectors of International Atomic Energy Agency to leave the country and claim that they're enriching uranium, which means implicitly saying that we are going to develop, gain the capacity to make nuclear weapons while denying that they have such intention, that could lead to a kind of confrontation that military action would be an option for the United States. And given the fact that Bolton and a number of other right-wing people think this confrontation with Iran could lead to regime change in Iran, this is the pressuring Iran not only economically and politically as well as in the propaganda to force the regime to withdraw from the nuclear deal and expel the inspectors of International Atomic Energy from the country. But what is surprising them is that Iran has not done that. Iran remains committed to the nuclear deal and has convinced the European countries, that is the other four countries involved, that is the two members of four members of the National Security Council from Germany, they want to have to normalize trade and economic relations with the European countries. And of course, this situation puts the European Union, Great Britain, and the rest in a real dilemma. On the one hand, they do want to have normal trade relations with Iran. A number of European countries had even made some agreements with Iran. They had some deals in Iran. But if the United States is going to impose secondary sanctions, then obviously it would be disincentive for European companies and therefore European governments to persuade Iran. That's the meeting they had in New York yesterday. They were trying to persuade Iran to stay committed, continue to fulfill your responsibilities on the basis of nuclear deal, hoping that they would be able to persuade the United States to change its ways. But I doubt very much they will be able to influence Donald Trump.
Well, it was pretty clear on display today with President Trump's speech to the General Assembly at the United Nations, where he was greeted with mocking laughter when he was boasting about how great America is under him and how he's turned things around and this is the greatest government America's ever had and we're doing incredible things, et cetera, et cetera. And then he went on with this grab bag of bizarre stuff that he gets from right-wing fringe websites, from Fox News, a vision of the world, a version of the world that has no resemblance to reality, going after the globalists, that's the biggest threat, you know, not Russia, not China, but the globalists, socialists of, now I guess the communists are finished now, so socialism is the new enemy. And then you mentioned Germany, of course Germany's a part of the P5 plus one. He said, oh, Germany's getting all of its energy from, it's totally energy dependent, at which the German delegation just burst out laughing. Yes. They think this guy's a clown, a complete embarrassment. So what worries me is that the president who ran against the U.S. getting into more wars in the Middle East, and that's what his base liked about him, one of the things that they liked about him, he's out to lunch. Adelson's really running this show. He put Bolton in there. Bolton's deputy now is the point man on Iran working for Pompeo. That's what I fear, is that we should be watching Bolton and the agenda of the people behind Bolton and not be so focused on Trump, because I don't know that Trump knows what's happening, really.
You see, the irony is that Bolton was a promoter of the American invasion of Iraq in 2003, the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. And this was a fantastic gift, particularly to the right-wing elements in Iran. given the fact that the majority of the Iraqi population are of Shi'i faith. And the people who came to power in Iraq shortly after the invasion of Iraq by the United States, they had lived in Iran for 20 years. And not only that, there is evidence, and in fact, that the United States, the Congress of the United States passed a bill giving Ahmad Chalabi $2 million, millions of dollars, in order to organize Iraqi anti-Saddam group. Part of the money, he went to Ahmad Chalabi, was very close to Iranians. He actually paid the Iranian Revolutionary Guards in order to train and equip the Iraqi dissidents, some of the soldiers who had remained in Iran after the Iran-Iraq war. It's just incredible that in Iraq, the United States and Iran cooperated in the early stages of invasion of Iraq. And then when the ISIS took over parts of the territories of Iraq and Syria, the cooperation between the United States and Iran continued. So Bolton now is the fact that Iran has gained some influence in Iraq and in Syria and in southern Lebanon and perhaps even to Yemen. Their concern is really Iran's influence in the region. But the Iran's influence in the region was really given to them as a result of American policy and the right wing, the idea of invading Iran and exporting democracy and all that. So it's really an ironic situation we are facing in the Middle East.
And again, I'm speaking with Mansour Farhang, who's a professor emeritus of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendation to release its U.S. hostages. And his books include U.S. Imperialism, the Spanish-American War II, the Iranian Revolution, and the U.S. Press and Iran Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. So it's pretty clear that the Iran that Bolton and Netanyahu and Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, MBS, are portraying as this great menace, and that President Trump will certainly argue tomorrow before the UN Security Council, if it's a menace, it's a menace that was in effect empowered and enabled by the United States. And arguably, as much as that, if you use the soccer term, is an own goal for the U.S., Yemen appears to be an own goal for MBS, the Crown Prince. And he and Netanyahu and MBZ of the Emirates seem to be the ones behind the scenes pushing this thing. Bob Gates, the former Secretary of Defense, has warned that the Israelis and the Saudis want the Americans to fight the Iranians to the last American.
You see, Israel and Iran are intimate enemies in the sense that Israel wants to portray Iran as the real threat to the security of the Middle East and try to marginalize the Palestinian issue. And in other words, they exaggerate Iran's military capability, which is really absurd, because Iran, they have a ground force fundamentally to dealing with dissidents inside the country. But when it comes to military and air force and the modern equipment and all, Iran is really a third or fourth rate country. And yet Israel wants to portray this as the principal threat, and Saudi Arabia and the Iran's propaganda has also helped the Israelis. You know, they use each other. What Iran wants to do, Iran wants to present itself as the spokesperson and or the promoter of Islamic revival or radical Islam and transform the Israeli-Palestinian conflict into a conflict between Israel or Zionism and Islam. And it's very fascinating that the threat, the real or imagined threat of Iran, has helped the right-wing people in Israel. And Saudi Arabia, the Persian Gulf states, and the Gulf, they all, as a result of this propaganda, as well as Iran's propaganda itself, they have come to virtually cooperate with the United States and Israel in portraying Iran and thinking of Iran as the real threat to their security. This is really, that's why I refer to Israel and the Iranian regime as intimate enemies, that they need each other and they use each other in pursuit of their ideological, political, or geostrategic objectives. Yeah.
So if they have a symbiotic relationship, and I think your point's well taken, Mansour Farang, it's very odd in a way what's going on in Syria, where it looks as if Netanyahu's made a deal with Putin that the Israelis can bomb Iranian and Hezbollah targets, and Russia will not do anything about it. And of course, a Russian plane was recently shot down by accident by the Syrians. But now, of course, the Russians are saying they're going to supply the Syrians with the advanced ground-to-air anti-aircraft missiles. But notwithstanding, the point I want to make is that it seems that there may be some deal between Putin and Netanyahu over Syria. But my understanding is that Putin has already warned the Trump White House, and to some extent he's had buyer's remorse in helping get Trump into the Oval Office. He's now sort of realized that Trump is unstable and somewhat dangerous. And my understanding is that the Russians have warned the United States, if they do go to war against Iran, that Russia will side with Iran. Do you have any information in that regard?
I think, you know, Russia is using Iran. Iran is not really, Iran didn't have the military capability in fighting the ISIS. They organized some young Shiites from Pakistan, from Afghanistan, and from Iraq, as well as some members of the Revolutionary Guards. But without American Air Force or without Russian Air Force, that when they systematically bombed residential areas in Syria as well as the parts of the Iraq occupied by ISIS, then the forces of Iran were useful. It's really the relationship between Israel and Iran is extremely, you know, ironic. Even during the Iran-Iraq war, when Iran needed some spare parts for its American-made helicopters, and at that time, because of the hostage taking, there were sanctions against Iran, and Iran could not purchase these things in open market, Israel was willing to sell them to Iran. And then when the commander of the Iranian Air Force told Ayatollah Khomeini, who had declared his animosity toward Israel and wanting to destroy Israel and all that, when he told him that these spare parts are coming from Israel, and Khomeini says, are the salesmen Israelis? The colonel said, no, the salesmen are Italian and Portuguese. He said, we are not religiously obligated to ask him where they get the merchandise. It's incredible.
Right.
But that's why, because Israel wanted the Iran-Iraq war to continue, definitely did not want Saddam Hussein to win that war. And in other words, as Henry Kissinger said, the purpose of the United States is served when both sides lose. And that was, regrettably, these two dictators, Saddam Hussein and Ayatollah Khomeini, they were engaging in a war that was had absolutely nothing to do with the security and welfare of their own people, but it pleased many actors and arms promoters in the world. 42 countries sold arms to Iran and Iraq. 11 countries, including all five permanent members of the Security Council, sold arms to both sides. So the real problem is, you know, criticism of U.S. policy and imperialism all aside, and it's extremely important to present it, and yet it is really the degenerate nature of these regimes and their disconnection with people and their pathological ideology of wanting to dominate the regime that prepares the ground for use of foreign powers. And Russia is doing it in, you know, can you imagine that in a country with 23 million people in Syria, 11 million have been removed from their homes, 11 million people becoming refugees. It's just incredible. And then they say Syria needs at least $500 billion for rebuilding the country. Who is going to pay that? Obviously, Russia is not going to pay anything to Syria, and these are the Western countries. And yet these autocratic dictatorial regimes staying in power means they can do anything. And it's really regrettable that even, you know, Iran, if they ignore Donald Trump, if they ignore his kind of threat, they would have a better time to work with the European countries. And instead of ignoring it, they continue to play the kind of game particularly in terms of propaganda, in the Middle East, that it threatens the status quo. It threatens the regimes. That it has created an implicit coalition between Saudi Arabia and Israel. And this was exactly the goal of Netanyahu's policy and promotion and present portrayal of Iran as the major military threat. So it's really incredible that. And then when you go to the region, because it's always projection, always finding other people responsible for what is going on inside the countries, has become an excuse. The real problems are inside the country and the autocratic nature of the regimes and their relationship with their societies.
And of course, just on top of all this, the regime now in Tehran is rattled by the attack on the IRGC down in the southwest. Just in closing, you've given us the impression that Iran is not a military power in spite of what the Americans, the Israelis, and the Saudis are saying.
Not at all. Even but the amount of money Iran spends on military is really much, much lower than what even the Persian Gulf states or Saudi Arabia. There is absolutely no comparison. More than that, Persian Gulf states and Saudi Arabia have an alliance with have a security alliance with the United States, and Iran is not going. Iran is not going. The rulers in Iran, one thing they are, one could say, they're very much interested in protecting the regime and remaining in power, and they know that any kind of military attack on Kuwait or United Arab Emirates or Saudi Arabia will inevitably bring the United States in. And then they will lose the war. They will be losing. They will not do that. And yet their propaganda, which is religiously oriented, threatens many of these regimes. At the end of the second year of the Iran-Iraq War, when Iranians managed in June 1982, when Iranians managed to expel all Iraqi forces from the Iranian territory, Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates offered Iran $20 billion for war reparation if Iran accepts the ceasefire, the UN resolution calling for ceasefire in the war. Khomeini rejected that and said the route to Jerusalem is through Karbala.
Good Lord. Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Mansour
Farhang. Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mansour Farhang, who's a professor emeritus of international relations at Benning College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendation to release its U.S. hostages. And his books include U.S. Imperialism, the Spanish-American War to the Iranian Revolution, and the U.S. Press and Iran Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.